The Guardian.
This month's guest at the Guardian Book Club was Bret Easton Ellis, who spoke to John Mullen about his novel American Psycho. First published in 1991, it has been shocking readers ever since, with its combination of brash materialism and graphic brutality. Ellis spoke about the aesthetics of violence and whether it is a betrayal for a feminist to even pick up American Psycho, but he started by returning to the inspiration of the novel, which he began writing when he was living in New York.
During that period that I was living in New York, when I was writing American Psycho, and let's get back to the idea that, first of all, American Psycho started with me moving to New York in, I think, 1987 as a young man and feeling very alienated and lonely and isolated and very frustrated with the idea that I was entering into the world of adults and that I thought their world kind of sucked and that this whole consumerist society that everyone was a part of and that encouraged me to be a part of it because it was supposed to make me happier. Really wasn't making me any happier and was making me angrier and more rage-filled. And that really was the genesis for Patrick Bateman. Patrick Bateman was not this kind of metaphorical idea I had about America or about Wall Street at that time. Patrick Bateman really came from me and where I was. And I had a lot of similarities with Patrick Bateman. And it's only been recently that I've, you know, felt comfortable enough to talk about that. And I was always in a very defensive mode about the book. And I always, you know, I would say it was about other things when in reality it really was about me. So during that time, I did all of the things that the people I knew who were adults and who were part of the yuppie culture, which is really just the consumerist culture, were doing at that time. I was trying to buy the right suits and trying to, like, be that guy and going to the right clubs and the right restaurants. And during that particular period, there was this nouvelle cuisine going on in the United States. And some of it was quite delicious, actually. Yeah. I'm not, like, knocking all of it at all. A lot of it I enjoyed, but then it got to a point where some of it was very silly and also very, very expensive because of its presentation and because of certain ingredients. And I thought, you know, it was worthy of, you know, something to mock, I guess. I don't know. But I did eat my fair share of it.
It seemed to me that the meals kind of started out sort of almost believable and then became slowly, and you suddenly realized that actually they'd been unbelievable for the previous 10 chapters, but you hadn't, you'd only just spotted it.
Well, that's true with the rest of the book as well.
Yes.
With his sanity. I mean, you start noticing that more and more as the book progresses. So, yeah, there was a plan.
Yeah.
I think
my favorite one is actually, I think it's kind of some of quite subtle, small ones that I really like the one, for appetizer, I ordered radicchio with some kind of free-range squid. And
I like that one. That's probably my favorite. Yeah. I like the idea of free-range squid.
Free-range squid is brilliant.
It does. That always makes me happy whenever I see that.
I think when I first read the book, that free-range slipped past me. I don't think I got it then. But I picked it up.
I was prescient.
Another thing, of course, is which surely required research as well as invention is the clothes. You know, everybody he sees, of course, he kind of runs through their clothes. And just now and then, the thing I like about it is now and then he says he was wearing Bill Blass this and Armani that, and I think shoes by. Were you fastidious about making all that sort of possible, or did you just elaborate as it came to you?
No, I was very fastidious about making that possible. I was also very conscious of the fact that if you actually went through the book and you dressed the characters, you visualized what they were wearing, that everyone would look ridiculous, that nothing would match. Yeah. Everyone would look like a clown. All the suits that people are dressed in, the shirts that don't match, the ties that don't match, the outlandishness of the designs of the suits that Patrick Bateman is talking about reveal like this absurd pattern of dressing among the men and women in the book. It's not something that I think, or I would hope, that the average reader who would pick up on. But for those who know a lot about fashion, reading that book is probably more frightening and nightmarish than any other book.
Did you kind of go into shops, or did you have it there? Were you so au fait?
Magazines. Oh, something called magazines, and I would look through magazines.
It's that buy that I'd sort of never been kind of conscious of in the same way before I read the novel, that restaurants are by somebody, you know, and the kind of word which I used to associate with kind of, I don't know, great novels or paintings mm-hmm. becomes a sort of word for the authoring of a tie.
It's where we're going. Yes, yeah. We're moving forward. We're moving into the culture.
I suppose one thing that I guess people associate with kind of several of your narrators that's true of Patrick Bateman is something which, again, I think was kind of quite unusual, probably in 1991, but I don't know, in Britain, in British novels now, is much, much more common for some reason or another, which is telling the story in the present tense. And I know you don't always do this, but you know, less than zero is basically in the present
yes,
tense
yes.
and imperial bedroom.
Yes.
I mean, I wonder if you could tell us something about why that's. Why do you just find it a natural mode, or was it a sort of a hard choice?
Oh no, not a hard choice. No. Writing can't be a hard choice. Nothing about writing can be a difficult choice like that. It just. I mean, it's a very boring answer, but it just felt natural. It just felt the way. How I wanted to tell stories. And I wrote many drafts of Less Than Zero in present tense. I did write one draft of it in past tense that didn't work.
So why do you think it didn't work in the past tense?
Because I was trying too consciously to write a novel. And I was in a very self-conscious mode at the time I was doing one of the final drafts of Less Than Zero. Because all the other kind of earlier drafts of it that were much more autobiographical and journalistic and had a lot to do with my actual day-to-day life, and my day-to-day life in high school too as well, were in the present tense, and it was a mode that I liked to write in. But I was getting to this point where I was writing the novel, a version of the novel for a writing teacher for the first time, and I was in college, and I felt that I had to follow the tropes of the classic novel, and it had to be in third person, and it had to be in past tense, and it was an utter failure. It just, the sensibility did not come together with that kind of writing. It just didn't. There was something else at play in the material and in whatever was going on in my mind and how I wanted to move this material across. That got completely derailed by using the classic idea of the classic tropes of the novel, which are third person past tense. And so when I went back to the book and I moved it into present tense first person, it kind of exploded and it just made utter sense to me. But I can't explain to you why that was the mode that I feel most comfortable in working, and it just does. I don't know. It might be that it was kind of trendy at the time, that present tense was a popular mode for a lot of short stories, as was minimalism,
yeah.
Both which influenced me greatly when I was working on Less Than Zero. And I wrote many novels in first-person present tense, which I actually now think is one of the trickiest things to do, one of the hardest things to do. And in my last book, in Lunar Park, I did revert to a past tense.
Yeah.
And ironically, that is the book that most sounds like my voice when I'm writing emails or when I'm just talking to anybody. There's something very stylized about first-person present tense that I actually find very arresting and gripping.
It gives American Psycho a particular kind of comic nightmarishness because, I mean, there's no sort of vantage point beyond what's happening to him where it's not like somebody standing back and looking at something that's happened and saying, you know, making sense of it. It's just happening.
Yeah, well, that's what also makes it very suspenseful. And I think there is a kind of suspense where this story is not being told, is actually unfolding in front of the reader.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
we don't really know how it's going to end.
And what about what's often, I think, sometimes rather inaccurately commented on as described as the sort of affectlessness of the narration? I mean, people often say there's no emotion, although, of course, he actually claims that sometimes he does feel, he says things like, oh, I felt really sad for some reason, but then I had a corona and the feeling went away. And well, he claimed...
Haven't you ever felt that way? I mean, it happened to me. It happened to me at 5 o'clock today. I don't know. I was feeling rather bummed and I don't know.
But that's a kind of, that's a difficult style to kind of hold to, isn't it? When it's so different from what we as people may say about what we think about things, how we judge things, to make a narrator who speaks of, I suppose, the effect is this kind of extraordinary incongruity, speaks of things which we would normally think of as rather different in their significance, as if they're the same, in the same sentence often, just in the, you know,
yes.
I ate a blini, I tortured the dog, and, you know, that...
Yes. Yeah, the response to the books from a certain kind of community that is very critical of the books is that there is an effectlessness to them and there is a numbness to them, and that because of that numbness, it negates the feelings that we're supposed to have when we read a novel.
Yeah,
as
yeah,
if
I
there's
guess
a list,
do, yeah,
as if
yeah.
there's a list of things and associations that we're supposed to have when we read a book, and as if numbness isn't a feeling. You know, numbness is a feeling. It's like, you know, to encounter that in a work can be very interesting, and it can be a feeling as much as excitement or sadness or horror can be. But, you know, a lot of it just comes from what I was interested in doing stylistically. And I felt that the subject matter and the narrator demanded this kind of language. And the kind of milieus that I was interested in investigating and the characters that I was interested in using as narrators, to me, that's how they would speak. But at the same time, I think it evolved. I think it became very different. The only times where it has really been flat and humorless has been Less Than Zero and Imperial Bedrooms. The other times, it's been slightly enlivened by these different narrators that I was using between both books, whether it was the students in Rules of Attraction or Victor Ward, certainly in Glamorama, who's a motor mouth and is, you know, I think really not describing things in an effectless way at all. I think it's wrong to for a critic to look at that book and say that that's happening. I think there's quite a bit of feeling in that book from Victor Ward. He's looking at everything in the wrong way, but he's still reacting and he still wants things, and I think he's hungry about stuff. And I think the same thing's true with Patrick Bateman in a strange way. I think Patrick Bateman is really kind of funny, and I agree with a lot of his criticisms about society. I think he's right about a lot of stuff. I feel pity for him as well. And so the criticism that I get about this like stylistic numbness to my work, I don't know. I think that comes from a certain kind of sensibility that is not looking under the surface of the novel and seeing that there's another world existing underneath that surface. And that is a problem for very literal-minded readers who encounter my fiction and write about my fiction. If you're very literal-minded, you're probably not going to get it. Or conversely, you're going to get it in, I don't know, in a different way. You're going to like read Less Than Zero and come up to me at a party in LA, which has happened for the last 4 years, and you say, oh man, you wrote Less Than Zero. That's the reason I moved to LA. That's so cool. You know, it's like, so, and what can I say about that? Can I walk away disgusted, which I'm not, by the way, or can I say, oh, that's really cool, dude. Yeah, I hope you make it. I mean, I don't know.
Do you think, you don't think that there are people who read American Psycho and went out and bought the Whitney Houston albums that they didn't already have?
No, I don't believe that, no.
Because I mean, as a maybe a riposte to those who want some emotion. I mean, of course, he does, in these kind of what I think of as kind of great set pieces of banality, he does express a lot of emotion when he sort of analyzes the discography of Whitney Houston or daringly, I think, on your part, Huey Lewis and the News.
The problem with discussing things like this is that the author, who for the most part writes a novel purely on an emotional basis and from an emotional need to express himself or to answer questions about his own life because of pain, chaos, stress, that really is where a novel, I think, in my life has stemmed from. And why I've created a novel is that I'm going through something that I don't understand. And so you write this novel, and it kind of answers a lot of things for you. It is an exorcism of some kind, and certainly American Psycho was an exorcism for me. But the problem, and we talked about this briefly backstage, is that as the author, I don't know why a lot of things in that book exist the way they do. Sure, I have an outline. Sure, I have a plan. Sure, there are certain aesthetic things that I want to do that I think are interesting. But I often encounter, especially with people who write like graduate papers or whatever they call them here, theses, PhDs, whatever they are, I read them and I go, oh my God, that is absolutely brilliant. And I have no idea how I did that. I never meant to do that, but that's right. That person connected the dots and that completely exists in the book. My God. So, the idea of the magician, in a way, talking about why the music chapters are there, especially after a particularly violent sequence or not, you know, I don't know how I can answer that. I don't know how I can talk about that. I don't know how I can talk about why during those sequences, the music sequences, that Patrick Bateman expresses this kind of emotion that he is not able to fully express, though I don't think, I think that's kind of a misreading of it. Not that you misread it, but I think there's a misreading of it. I think Patrick Bateman is constantly trying to connect. I think that's what the whole novel is about. It is about his dying to connect with people and people refusing to connect with him, and I think that is why those sequences where he's talking about music become so passionate in a way. It's almost a metaphor for writing, you know? It's also almost a metaphor for how we live our lives, you know? You live your daily life in a way where there are a lot of misconnections, there is a lot of banality, there is a lot of numbness, there is a lot of misconnections. And yet, if you're keeping a journal or if you're writing fiction or something, there is a way of controlling that chaos and of expressing yourself in a way that the world doesn't let you do, really, that the world doesn't want you to do, that the world doesn't want to hear all about your hopes and your dreams and your fears or whatever. And I think especially in a society as cruel and bleak and as consumed with itself as the society of American Psycho is, I don't know. I think those rage-filled fantasies and those passionate music chapters, it makes a kind of emotional sense to me. But I don't think ever for one minute in that book Patrick Bateman wasn't trying to connect. I think he was, and that's the problem. No one was connecting back with him.
I think more than a couple of people have said to me over the years about this book that the Genesis chapter, which is the first of the three, was kind of the moment at which they kind of twigged that the book was comedy, was satire, you know, and that kind of...
Too late. Too late. If you don't get it before then, I don't know. Just joking, yes, Genesis is fine. It's fine if you start finding it.
You want them to twig sometime.
Yeah.
Better late than never.
Yeah. That was very hard to write.
It
was very hard to write. I keep joking about that. The most harrowing.
Did you listen to that? You had to listen to them all.
Was the most harrowing aspect of writing American Psycho. It really wasn't the bit with the rat. It really was listening to Genesis for a month, which was look, not a terrible band, whatever. I mean, it was just a band that I thought that was very popular at the time and that I thought Patrick Bateman would like, and it really was. That was the hardest month of writing on that book, was listening to all the Genesis music and and writing what is essentially a really long,
it is, yeah,
long piece on Genesis.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've suffered for your art, God
knows.
I'll
never do it again.
I'm going to throw it open to your readers, the proper readers, in a second. But we haven't actually really talked about the thing that I'm sure you get bored with being asked about.
Well, then let's not talk about it.
Okay. All right, well, can I ask you, I'm going to ask for your sort of authorial kind of absolution. What I'm going to say is, the particularly in the second half of the book, the some of the violent chapters, I didn't kind of read all of them. And, I mean, I sort of knew what they were, I think I kind of knew what they were doing, and I started reading them, and I wasn't appalled or offended, but I didn't actually make myself go through every sentence. And is that a kind of critical failure, do you think?
Yes, I do, actually. I do.
I kind of knew as I embarked on this.
That was.
Yeah.
Oh, whatever. I mean, every reader is different. What can I say? You know, you read a book, you finish it, you don't finish it. I don't know.
Well, I think it's time. It's more than time for me to ask your readers what they would like to ask you. There's two at the front.
I was just interested in what you thought of the film adaptation of American Psycho, what you thought of the screenplay of it and the performances, and whether it captured the spirit of the book. And also, I'm curious if you ever saw American Psycho 2, the straight-to-video William Shatner monstrosity.
I saw a little bit of American Psycho 2. Okay, but about the film version of it, you know, it's interesting. I was going through all my press today for this tour, and there was a big thing on American Psycho about the making of the film. And I've been kind of slagging off on the movie a little bit because I have an issue about the idea of even turning that book into a film. I think the things that make the book interesting cannot be adapted into another medium. And I think the way the movie resolves that problem isn't particularly interesting. And I think the fact that readers always ask me, well, did he do it or did he not do it? I don't have an answer to that. And I find that interesting. I find the fact that there's an unreliability to that book very mysterious and gripping. The movie, by the very nature of the medium of film, has to answer that. And it does. It answers it by showing the scenes, by actually showing the scenes. And so the movie becomes, well, what does it become about? It becomes a kind of light comedy of manners among people in New York and a guy who's Christian Bale and kind of crazy and, you know, whatever. I mean, it's very well done, but it's just, I conceived the book, as something to only experience as a novel and not to experience in any other way. And I always found it very strange that so many people wanted to turn American Psycho into a movie. So many actors wanted to be in it. So many directors wanted to direct it. And I guess that had a lot to do with the controversial nature of its reception. But saying that, yes, the movie is extremely well made. And I think as a novelist, I should be very happy with it. You know, it's not an embarrassment by any means. It's actually quite well done. And I like it. I like it. I do.
There's a...
I do.
Gentleman up there, can you make yourself heard?
I'll try. Were you scared to write the book in terms of knowing that your friends and people you'd have relationships with in the future would know you had some of these dark thoughts inside you? I mean, I think everyone has some of these dark thoughts, but you start keeping them inside.
No, I didn't really, I wasn't afraid at all to write the book, and I didn't find it scary to write, except about a couple weeks near the end of the writing of American Psycho, yeah, I got a little freaked out because I had saved the murder sequences toward the end of the writing of the book because I didn't know how to write them, and I was relying on criminology textbooks in order to get details. And I had been living with Patrick Bateman for like 3 years by then. And so I knew his voice so well that the details in the criminology textbooks that I was reading, which were like just study books for students who want to be in the FBI or whatever, well, sort of like what Clarice Starling was going through in her training, would probably read these textbooks about serial killers. And so that That was kind of a depressing 2 weeks, just writing those sequences. But also, you know, you're a technician, and you feel it's part of an aesthetic plan. And as a writer, you feel you need to write those scenes. But I never had a problem at all with the idea that I was going to offend a friend or a family member or someone, or that I was going to, like, piss someone off because I was writing a novel. And honestly, even if I was, you know, screw it. You still do it. You don't let that hold you back from expressing yourself as an artist. There was a problem, however, with the dedication to American Psycho, which was to my best friend, a guy named Bruce Taylor, who I met in seventh grade, and who taught me what was, I think, really funny. He taught me stuff that was really funny. He was a really funny guy, and he had the darkest sense of humor. He's still around. I mean, I'm talking about him in the past tense. I just saw him like 2 weeks ago in LA. But he had a really twisted sense of humor, very deviant sexuality, and he would just shock the hell out of me with his observations in seventh grade, eighth grade. I'm talking about when we were like 12, 13, 14 years old. And of course, he went on to become a screenwriter, and he's living in LA. But I told him, look, I couldn't have written American Psycho without you, because, you know, Patrick Bateman is so much, like, so much of the humor in the book is so black, and it really comes from knowing you for the last 14 years or whatever. And he said, he begged me not to dedicate the book to him. Begged me to. I said, his life was already difficult enough, and I don't want this to be dedicated to me. And I said, well, I'm going to do it anyway, and no one's really going to know. And now he uses it as a badge of honor, as a way of getting laid. American Psycho was dedicated to me. It's so weird how it's changed.
It's like, true.
In 91, girls would have been repelled. Now they're throwing themselves at
it. There's a lady at the front.
Hi, yeah. I first read American Psycho when I was on holiday with my family when I was about 16 or 17. And had an excruciatingly embarrassing thing that my grandmother actually walked in on me masturbating while I was reading the book. And then went on to read the book herself. And she was about 87 at the time and spent the rest of the holiday kind of staring at me in a slightly disgusted way. But what I really
was
wondered about...
Was she masturbating
about,
too?
Yeah, at the table. But what I really wondered was, to me, it was really key that you kind of built up this sense of kind of sexual tension and kind of stuff before you went on to the violence, because it made him as a character more credible to me, because it sort of made you kind of feel like you could understand a bit more about how he was kind of led on to these things rather than coming in straight away into the kind of violent side of it. So I just kind of wonder, was that something purposeful that you kind of, a construct you set out to do to kind of pull people in like that, or is that just me?
I think that's a kind of question that's unique in the history of the Guardian book club.
It's a good question.
It's a good one, yeah.
I want to know more about the masturbating. You know, again, that's... I actually do want to know more about the masturbating. I really don't want to answer that question. I don't really have... I guess there's a very dry kind of thesis-type answer to that. Like, yes, I was quite aware that serial killers prey upon their victims sexually before they torture and dismember them. And I was trying to I wasn't thinking that at all. I was just going on how I just felt, you know, how I felt it should be. I know that's so unilluminating for you guys, but it's true. I mean, I can't fake it and tell you that there was any other reason.
Gentlemen, here.
A lot has been said about American Psycho in that, well, it's the kind of text that paints you as a kind of moralist. And having just read Imperial Bedrooms and the kind of reintroduction to your work of that violence against the person towards the end with Clay and the boy and the girl in the hotel room, or the villa, rather, whether your work on the kind of notion of violence is less to do with satire and more to do with the aesthetic, and that somehow reading about it is enjoyable in and of itself rather than just trying to make a point.
Reading about violence is enjoyable, and to be knocked for it is crazy, I think. I mean, to be knocked by a critic for using violence in your work as a means of getting at emotion as something that, as a device that I suppose an author uses is, you know, I almost think is immoral complaining about something like that. I don't know exactly. I'm not on the same page with the criticisms that I get about the violence in my work from people who judge the work on a moral level. I can't review a book on a moral level. I can't really read a book on a moral level. I don't really know what that means. But you're talking about the violence in the work and why it's there in a way is what you're asking. I mean, yes, on an aesthetic level, it makes sense to me in certain books to have scenes of extreme violence, depending on what the subject matter is and depending on who the narrator is. It's very basic. It's not that complex an idea, and it's not that complicated an artistic vision. It's basically, you know, it's what feels authentic for me at the time. And in American Psycho, for example, when I was outlining the novel and trying to figure it out, I realized that, okay, Patrick Bateman is this kind of guy, and so we're going to be I want to do an opening sequence where he's getting up in the morning and having his morning routine. Okay, that's going to be very detailed. And then I also want him to notice how everyone's dressed, but they're going to be dressed like crazily. And then I realized, oh, the sense of detail is going to spill over into the murders. Okay, this is an aesthetic plan. Okay, so, oh, well, I'm going to have to go there. Oh, well, I want to go there. That's going to be really interesting to write those scenes and to juxtapose the violence with this and this and this. And it was, you know, there was this emotional way of exploring, I don't know, this person's mind with a kind of aesthetic plan, et cetera, et cetera. And I misjudged, you know. I did it, and people became outraged by the violence. And the violence became extremely distracting for people who might have otherwise enjoyed the book or liked the book or gotten the book. For me, it's just when a book of mine is violent, it's violent because I feel that it just needs to be, and it's no more complicated really than that.
But what's the need for it within the text? I still don't.
Is there a particular text? Which text?
Well, one of my favorite lines from Imperial Bedrooms is, and the boy's mouth was warm, but I didn't really feel anything until I hit him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a beautiful line, mm-hmm. but it's really disturbing.
Yes, it is.
And I just wonder, I just wonder what you're feeling when you write it, and rather than using words like it makes sense and it's authentic, I kind of want to know why it's there.
I don't know why.
Okay.
I really don't know why. It felt like something that Clay would, at that point in the novel, when the novel kind of explodes, it felt like a detail that he would relate at that point to the reader. I don't think he would relate that point to the reader on page 10 or 12, but on page 150 or whatever, that he's already unhinged enough, and he's already has spiraled so out of control that he's ready to, you know, relate that sequence to us. And I like that line too. I mean, and I wrote that scene hundreds of times, and I don't know why that particular line stayed in and other lines were removed. It just felt right. And I, again, that is a thesis question, and that is, I'm not making fun of that at all. It is a very interesting question, and one that I am not able to answer yet again, which is, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's just, that's the fact.
Then I should let someone else.
There's a gentleman up here, and then a lady just behind, and then a lady in the middle. Please.
I was fascinated reading Luna Park. I'm just curious on how you work while writing it.
Every book is completely an obsession. I mean, that's why I write the book. I mean, I don't write the book because I don't really feel like it. And it's like, oh, I'm kind of bored today, but I guess I'll go back to that old thing that's sitting in my... No, every book is written because I am obsessed with the idea of writing the book and exploring whatever's going on with this character. And I'm pretty fueled up during the writing. I don't get writer's block, and I don't go through this... I don't find writing a novel to be a pain and a struggle and something that's horrible to do. I find it fun, and it frees me from the daily weight of life and the daily pain of life. I'm transported by the act of writing. I like doing it, regardless of how dark the fiction is or wherever I'm at. So I keep fairly routine hours. I keep office hours. I write from 9 to 5, 10 to 6. And that was true of American Psycho as well. You know, Lunar Park is often misread as my apologia for American Psycho, which it is not at all. I am not apologizing for American Psycho, and a lot of people think that the Bret Easton Ellis of that book is me, and that I am apologizing for that, for American Psycho. And the way he describes the writing of American Psycho is absolutely not how I was working on American Psycho. He makes it seem as if Patrick Bateman was this, you know, monster that visited him in his dreams and forced him to write this book. Of course, that's what an apologist would say. I don't feel that way at all. I feel that that book, and I freely admit, was about me, and Patrick Bateman is me in a lot of ways, and it was a very, you know, a personal book, and I make no apologies for it. Lunar Park, that narrator does. And he is guilt-ridden by that book, and that book becomes something that torments him, both literally and figuratively. And I thought that was interesting. I thought it was interesting to play with that bit, as I thought it was interesting to play with the notion of Bret Easton Ellis in general.
There was a lady here. Yes.
I've just recently finished rereading American Psycho, and one of the things that really struck me was how homophobic Patrick Bateman is. And I was wondering if that was a reaction to anything you'd experienced as a young man, or really where that came from?
It came from just the notion of hanging out with men during that particular time in New York. And it was a very interesting time because it was the beginning of the rise of metrosexuality. And I think American Psycho is one of the first books that really does investigate that and preceded the idea of metrosexuality, which is now just part of our culture and part of the daily language of advertising and commercials and movies, and it's just how it is. And I think there was a kind of joking rejection of the acceptance of this kind of dandification of the American male, and it was often the jokes were often homophobic in nature because it was gay culture, in a way, was entering in and changing the way straight American men thought about themselves. And I think the rejection of it was, you know, manifested itself in a lot of homophobia and a lot of homophobic jokes. I think actually a character that's slightly more homophobic than Patrick Bateman is Victor Ward. For long stretches of Glamorama, makes glaringly homophobic jokes constantly throughout the text, especially to his two gay assistants in the nightclub scenes. And then ultimately, of course, gets raped and likes it, you know? So, I don't know. I've always, but that came out wrong. He not gets raped and likes it. Gets fucked and likes it, I guess, is what I'm meaning to say, if that's any better. But yeah, that's actually where that, and actually, it's just the way, you know, honestly, it's the way a lot of straight men just, you know, act. I mean, homosexual jokes are just part of the language of, you know, not only straight culture, but gay culture as well. I mean, you should hear gay men joking about homosexuality. It's much more, in its way, if you wanted to, like, take it out of its context, it's much more homophobic than anything else. And I just don't even know what homophobia really even means anymore. It's nothing that I've ever been particularly interested in or paid much attention to.
There's a gentleman here, and there's a lady right at the back. I've been unfair to the people at the back, so.
Hi, I have another question about masturbation. In terms of when you were writing this book and maybe others as well, did you find that your ability to write it, certain scenes or parts of it changed, depending on whether you'd recently relieved yourself sexually or whether it was easier before jacking off or afterwards? Or such kind of thing?
Yes, I did.
And detailed as well. Not that, I mean, which continue.
Well, doesn't it always help? I mean, really, doesn't it always help? And then, isn't it always easier to write once you've done it? I don't know. To be very...
Football is a ban from doing it, I think.
Right, that so the athletes are. But is that really true, or is that an old wives' tale about people?
I don't know. Being able to, I mean, the England manager.
But,
I think.
But I don't. It really didn't make that much of a difference. I don't know. I was just like, just masturbating all the time. It doesn't really matter. It was like I was masturbating while writing it, after writing it, before writing it, when I was writing something else. It really didn't matter. It was just like, it was just a very, very jizzy time for
me. has the microphone reached the lady at the back?
It has, yeah. I don't know how to follow that question. I was going to ask about the repetition of characters throughout your books and to ask what the purpose or effect that has in your view.
You mean the same characters returning?
Yeah, the same characters, for example, Victor in Rules of Attraction, that kind of thing.
No plan. No, seriously, there isn't a plan. It's just something that I like to do. It amuses me. I think it's fun.
Could I ask what effect you think that has on the books?
Oh, what effect do I think it has on the books? I think for readers, they find it fun. They like it. They seem to like the idea that all the novels are linked together. And I mean, if you're asking for a kind of a critical analysis of why I do it, there really is not one. There isn't one. It's just, it's fun. And I remember when, you know, when I was writing Lunar Park, I had to figure out who the neighbors were of Brett and Jane, and I was kind of racking my head about, well, who's it going to be? And for no reason whatsoever, I came up with this guy from Rules of Attraction, Mitchell Allen, who was vaguely involved with Paul Denton and then left him for some girl and whatever. So, and then I really liked the idea because it allowed me to riff on Camden College and on Men of a Certain Age, and because Brett Easton Ellis character had gone to Camden College with Mitchell Allen, and they knew similar people there. It just was just fun to do, and it wasn't, you know, there wasn't a big plan. The effects on the reader seem to be very positive. People seem to like it. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to be in this position, to be sitting here and to be asked very intelligent and very serious questions about my work that I am not able to answer. It's a bit like a dream verging on a nightmare, in a way, to be in front of an audience that I think is expecting a writer to be much more aware of his effects than the writer actually is. And that's what I'm feeling during this. And it's not a terrible feeling, but it's interesting to not be that kind of writer, I suppose. I don't know. Yeah, sure, I have a bit of a plan. But when it comes down to answering, you know, these very, you know, kind of smart, very intelligent questions, and I, you know, feel like I feel a bit retarded.
Hello. You live in Los Angeles now, and obviously the novel's based in New York. Have you fallen out with New York, and do you think this could have worked in Los Angeles, in what they call La La Land? Do you think it would have been as effective?
Yeah, I suppose it could. Yeah, it could have, definitely. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, the novels definitely have a very specific milieu, often because I'm living wherever the novels are taking place. But I think the novels are about things that are much more universal than just place, or else I don't think they'd be as widely read if they were just so specifically about, say, Beverly Hills, or about the Upper East Side, or about a small liberal arts college in the corner of Vermont. I mean, really, obviously, because of how widely read these novels are, it doesn't matter where they're set, I believe. And I don't think the appeal of the books is necessarily the setting. So yes, I think the novels probably could have been set anywhere else, and there's something else at work in the novels that people are responding to.
The lady near the back, yes.
Hello, I'd like to ask you about Lunar Park. Was it a pleasure to write?
Was it what?
A pleasure to write?
It was a total pleasure to write, yes, it was. I wanted to write a Stephen King novel with ghosts running around a house. That's the impetus to write that book. And then as the years went on, the more and more I thought about that book, I waited 14 years to write that book. I wanted to write that book 14 years before I began it. I wanted to write that book while I was working on American Psycho. And then when American Psycho was done, I had a choice between going into Lunar Park or this other novel that I had in mind, which was I wanted to write also a Robert Ludlum novel because I liked Robert Ludlum novels, and I wanted to do kind of an international espionage thriller, but with one of my characters in the middle of it. And how would that affect things? How would it affect the international espionage thriller with someone who is so vapid they don't understand anything that's going on around them? I felt a lot more danger would occur because of that, and I thought it would be really interesting to turn it around. And when I realized that Lunar Park really, for it to work, really needed an older narrator, someone with a lot more of a past to be haunted by, I thought, okay, I'm gonna have to wait on that. And I'm the same age as Victor Ward, and I'm also into this whole idea of, I'm fascinated by this burgeoning celebrity culture, reality show, terrorism, and also the idea of something that had haunted me for a long time, which was the sense of the self being replaced by another self. And I think I experienced that in terms of becoming Brett Ellis into Brett Easton Ellis, this brand that people associate with a whole list of things that honestly in my daily life are not true. Just simply isn't true about the type of person I am, what my daily habits are, what my routines are, what I'm interested in. And yet I watched helplessly as that occurred. And there's nothing to do about it. It's something that more people would like to accept than the reality. And so being replaced by Brett Easton Ellis was something that I wanted to explore in Glamorama, which actively is what happens, you know, to Victor Ward during the course of that book. So I wrote Lunar Park instead, and I wrote Glamorama instead, and then after that, I felt enough time had passed that I could write Lunar Park. And then, of course, the Haunted House novel, by that time, morphed into a much more complicated novel about feelings about my father, who in the intervening years had died. And I'd been very conflicted by his death, and it was very unresolved. And writing Lunar Park ultimately became a kind of exorcism about my feelings about my father. We had a very bad relationship, for those of you who don't know that, and it was, you know, sort of unresolved. So rambling answer to a very simple question. But
lady in the middle.
Hi. You were saying that you connected with Bateman on a personal level, but I just kind of wondered that, especially in the context of the book, could you say that he didn't exist, that he was just kind of an extension of everyone's deep emotions, especially because all the characters who he's surrounded with are normally off their face, so they almost kind of bypass of what he's saying.
Well, they always call him by the wrong name, don't they?
They call him by his wrong name. I just wondered if he actually existed, if you had any thought about that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I did think about that for a little bit. I did think about the idea that it was a novel narrated by nobody. I did. I thought that this was every man, every yuppie, the spirit of every guy who was like Patrick Bateman in a way was narrating that book. And that there wasn't really a Patrick Bateman, that there was kind of this invisible... But then I discarded that after about 8 seconds. But I did briefly land on that. I thought that was interesting. But
I mean, especially in Lunar Park, I think it's near the beginning, the party scenes, when you just kind of see him pass, and it's almost the Bret Easton Ellis in there kind of wanders. Right. It's always thought he was kind of a shadow, you know, whether he was just an extension rather than a full character.
Yeah. Again, that's a very interesting observation.
Gentleman at the back.
Hi. You talked about writing being an obsession and also about Patrick Bateman kind of being an exorcism of yourself in a way. And sort of thinking about the novel, there are certain points where emotion does come through, contrary to a lot of the other points. Like, for example, I felt that with the section with the two cool girls, with the coat hanger, there's almost a kind of boasting emotion at the point where Patrick Bateman doesn't say what he did with them. And then when the narrative perspective shifts towards the end when he's being chased by the police. So I guess my question is, as you were writing it, and you mentioned it was an exorcism, did you have emotions coming through at any particular points in the novel that kind of spilled into the narrative, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does. Was I emotional while writing it?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, your own emotions at given points, like from did you write it from a chronological order from start to finish? And if so, as it was an exorcism, as
yes.
you sort of suggested,
yes.
were there points where you were like, oh, I'm really glad I got that out, and it kind of poured in?
Okay, completely, yes. Now that question completely makes sense to me. Yes, it was an exorcism from beginning to end, and by the end of that novel, I did feel, like I do with most novels, that I rid myself of some kind of pain or fear, and I worked it out on the page and within the context of a novel. yes, that definitely happened. Yes, the novel was written chronologically except for some of the murder scenes. And I felt that I had figured out something about myself and about what I desired and a kind of life that I wanted to live after I finished writing American Psycho, as ridiculous as that might sound for some people who don't like the book. But it's true. That is true.
You're saying that it's like an exorcism for you, writing. Was the psychological aspect of Patrick Bateman, which is a really interesting one, was that an extension of how you were feeling, or did you research psychological problems and disorders that someone like him might be going through?
Did you swat up on psychopaths?
Why couldn't you just say that? Now I understand the question. A bit. Yes, I did. I did read about American serial killers. I don't know how much it really helped, but yes, I did do some research. I read about people like Ted Bundy, especially. I read a lot of Ted Bundy biographies, and they were helpful to a degree in terms of certain sequences in it, but a lot of American Psycho isn't about any of that at all. A lot of it takes place in clubs and restaurants and on dates and in concerts and in social groups with other guys. And that was really, that to me was the gist of the novel. These sequences that were hideously violent could be fantasies, they could be reality, I don't know, but they were, not as rooted in, basically the book really wasn't rooted in that kind of psychological research. Patrick Bateman was really kind of an extension of who I was. All right.
Okay, so the lady with the skull.
You've had your hand up for most of the time, why anyone hasn't called upon you.
Go on, try. I think it's working.
Is this working?
Yes.
It is. Okay, I'll try and make it an interesting question for you. I just wanted to know how the, you mentioned all the press attention, obviously, and reactions to American Psycho, and I wondered how that affected you as a writer in terms of your subsequent writing, if it had any impact.
It didn't. It didn't affect it at all. It would have affected it if I had believed in any of the controversy, if I had believed in the misreading of the book, if I had believed the liberal press's attempt to censor the book. It wasn't conservatives trying to censor that book. It was the liberal press. It was the New York Times. It was well-meaning people who were siding with the politically correct who wanted to censor that book. It was feminists who wanted to censor that book. It was not the right old school feminism, not new school feminism, because half of my audience now is women, actively women, and at most, as we see here tonight, half of the audience is women, and younger women too, by the way, for the most part. We're talking about an old school type of feminism that attacked that book and hated it. I find it to be on the list of many young women's favorite novels. So it's shifted radically, the whole notion of feminism. is different now. If I believed in what everyone was saying about the misreading of that book, yeah, I probably would have been, devastated and probably could not have, written another word. I guess if I had cared more. But I didn't really care so much about it because it was so hysterical and it was so wrong. And there was such a hysterical misreading of the book that, yes, it was distracting. Yes, there were months where I wasn't working on the novel that I wanted to be working on because of dealing with that. But it did not change the book that I was working on next, which was Glamorama. And it didn't really alter putting together The Informers. And it didn't really alter anything else. It added some kind of humor for me about in Luna Park, but overall, no. But you had a follow-up to this, right? You're holding the mic.
Well, am I allowed? Yeah, I just wonder, in terms of your follow-up then, Glamorama, I haven't read that. I don't know how many people here, probably all big fans, but whether that creates a pressure on you as a writer to match or equal at all in your head?
No, never. You cannot work that way as a writer. I do not write books to compare or compete with each other. I don't rate my books. I don't stack them up against each other. Every book is written during a certain time of my life and reflects whatever my interests are. I do not try to outdo myself each time. That is a losing game for a writer. And I cannot imagine being that self-conscious about your output that you approach fiction writing that way. Ridiculous. You write what you feel, and that is simply where you are at any given, you know, period in your life. But I can't operate that way as a writer.
Your publisher might think differently, though, at the time.
Yeah, but I'm not my publisher. My publisher thinks a lot of things. My publisher, you know, thought when I told them I was writing Imperial Bedrooms, ka-ching, ka-ching, you know, and then I turn in a very kind of a much different, darker, more depraved novel than I think they wanted or they think that they expected. I don't know what they expected, and I'm not talking about my UK publishers, by the way. I'm talking about my American publishers. But yeah, I mean, my publishers are the publishers, and they've got to grapple with how to sell a novel. I don't have to deal with that at all. I don't deal with that part of the process. And as a writer, I am relieved not to have to deal with that part of the process.
Well, I just wanted to say that despite Brett's claims not to have answered or been able to answer most of our questions, I want to thank him for actually, in fact, answering them rather amusingly and eloquently. And I hope everybody here agrees.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.